You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 16th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey there, folks.
So, Evan, you leave in 2 days for your eclipse extravaganza, huh?
Oh, my gosh. This is it. I waited so long for this moment. Amazing. And the weather forecast looks good for where I'm headed.
Excellent.
So I'm so happy about that. You have no idea.
You understand that weather systems are chaotic and the errors multiply over time, and that so long-term predictions are worthless, right? So,
but we're only a few days away now.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
You're so kind, Bob.
Chaos. Chaos, my friend. Sensitive dependence to initial conditions.
So, now, Evan, you've been waiting this for longer than I've been alive.
Isn't that incredible? I'm old. I mean, that's another way of putting it.
Well, you said since 1979, right? And I was born in 83, so 4 years longer than I've been alive. This has been in your journal. Like, it's been a date on your calendar. How exciting is that?
Well, this was my first foray, my first infatuation with science when we learned about the total solar eclipse that occurred in 1979. I was 9 years old, but in third grade. And we spent, I don't know, a month sort of just, you know, talking about it and going over things and drawing pictures of it and studying about it. And it just became really my first love in science. Got me on the way definitely to where I am today.
Wow. I didn't know that, Ev. That's really cool.
Bob, it's supposed to be cloudy here where we live for the next 10 days, except Monday the 21st.
It's sunny.
It's like this one little brief moment of sunniness. For now, as you say, weather is chaotic, so we'll have to keep an eye out on that.
Well,
I am the Rob McKenna from the Hitchhiker's Guide of astronomical events. You know Rob McKenna, the guy wherever he went, it was raining because the rain gods loved him. I am the same way. So, Evan, will you pay me not to go where you go?
Right? Let's see. Let me. I got $50,000 in the account, so you can have it all.
So
I'll be generous.
You guys,
I'll take half.
You know who's in town right now? He actually flew to the States to see the eclipse, and we got to go have breakfast together yesterday. Is Iran from the Australian Skeptics.
Yeah, he's coming here.
Nice. Wow, man. He came all the way for it.
And we had the sweetest chat, and he told me about the time when he got to see a total solar eclipse. And he said that there's literally, like, it's really hard to put into words, but the difference between it being partial and going to totality is just, you'll never forget it for the rest of your life.
Two different worlds, they say.
Oh, my God.
And wow. It's indescribable, and that's what I've been trying to describe to people for so long now.
That's why no one believes you, Evan. I thought exactly. It was ineffable.
So Bob just realized, because I told him, that even though we are not in the path of totality, we're still going to get a partial solar eclipse. I mean, it's still going to be an eclipse.
A good one.
Yeah, everyone in the United States will.
Everyone in the United States. So yeah. We're going to get like 75% coverage here at most. But I have to point out that partial coverage of the sun is even more dangerous. Like when you're in totality, you could actually look at the sun because there's nothing there. But if there's just a sliver of the sun, that's when it's most dangerous because that's bright enough to slice out your retina, but not bright enough to cause you to wince in pain. Mm-hmm. So you'll like look at the sliver, moving your eyes around, carving out little slices of your retina. So,
okay,
it's so graphic.
I mean, it's an instant slice.
I don't know how instant it is, but I wouldn't look at it at all. You know,
and you absolutely shouldn't do is look through binoculars or a telescope unless they are
properly filtered.
Yeah,
properly filtered.
And if you're interested in why, you can Google. I think it was on Io9 or something. Somebody actually did an experiment where they held a telescope or they trained a telescope on the sun and then put like a cow's eye behind it. It's pretty fun to watch.
Oh,
whoa.
Boy.
Yeah. Hey, it's not too late, everyone listening to this show. I told my three people, did everybody on this show and everyone listening to this tell three people not to look at the sun?
Yes. Not only
more
did I do
eye
that,
protection.
More
I bought all my friends that I'm going to be around eye protection.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm bringing extra as well. I've got about a half dozen extra sets of glasses that are certified. I've checked them all out online. It meets all the codes. It's all regulated, and they are not fakes. They are not counterfeits. So I'll be helping some people with those as well.
Cool. And Kara, you have a special What's the Word this week all about the eclipse.
Yeah, well, I thought it would be fun to go through some of the different terms that you may hear people saying if you're watching any coverage of the eclipse, or if you go to a place where there are a lot of amateur astronomers or professional astronomers, because you'll probably be hearing a lot of different terms. So I think first we should start with the conversation. Actually, I think we actually mentioned this offline before we started recording, because I did my nails up for the eclipse. And Bob said, is that an annular eclipse? And I was like, it's an attempt at a total eclipse. So what is the difference between an annular eclipse and a total eclipse? Well, an annular eclipse is one in which the moon is too far away from Earth to completely cover the sun. So even though it traverses, you're still going to see a really blindingly bright ring surrounding the moon. But what we are seeing in the path of totality in America is an actual total eclipse. And that is the case where the moon is close enough to Earth that it's large enough to completely cover the sun. So the only thing that you see around it is a very faint corona. And that's what Steve was talking about when he said you can actually take off your eclipse glasses only during totality, only if you are in the path of totality. And it's really important to make sure that as soon as the sun starts to peek back out, you put on that eye protection. All right, so how about next one? I think this is a good word everyone should know. And maybe, Bob, you can pitch in with this. What is an umbra?
A shadow.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a darkness.
It's a type of shadow.
So the umbra is the darkest part of the moon's shadow. So when the moon is in front of the sun in a total eclipse, the sun is completely blocked by the umbra. That's in contrast with the penumbra, which you've probably heard of. The penumbra is the weak part or the pale part of the shadow. So that is happening more in a partial eclipse. The sun's only partially blocked by the moon, by the moon's penumbra then. And then, of course, there is another phrase, which maybe is, I think, a little less common to hear, and that is the antumbra. And that's the part of the moon shadow that extends beyond the umbra. So it's similar to the penumbra in that it only partially blocks the moon. But when the antumbra is there, the sun actually appears larger than the moon. And you can see a full silhouette there. That happens during the annular eclipse. And then there's a few more really fun ones. These are the phases. And so if you're looking at coverage or listening to coverage while you're watching, you might hear the terms first, second, third, and fourth contact. So let's go through each of those in order. So in first contact, that's the instant right when the partial phase of the eclipse begins. So the minute that you start to see the moon moving in front of the sun, that's first contact. Second contact is a little bit more specific. This is when the total or the annular phase of an eclipse begins. So this is when the moon is completely in front of the sun. But of course, it still moves a little bit, and that's why totality has different lengths. For example, where Evan is going to be, the totality length is close to 2 minutes. Where I am first driving into, the totality length is only about 40 seconds. So I'm hoping to go a little farther north to get a little bit more. The third contact is once that totality or the annular phase is ending and it's moving over to become partial again. And then the fourth contact is at the very last point of the partial eclipse. So you can kind of know where you are in the eclipse phases by using those terms. Obviously, totality, we've mentioned already, that is when the moon is right in front and completely blocking so that you only see that faint corona behind it. And then there's a couple, I think, more words that you probably won't hear unless you're talking to astronomers about it, but I think it's important to talk about them. The first one and the one after that actually get confused quite a bit. They're sometimes used as synonyms, although they're a little bit different. So let's talk first about eclipse magnitude. Eclipse magnitude is actually the fraction of the diameter of the sun that is covered by the moon. And it's mathematical. It's a ratio of diameters eclipse obscuration is the fraction of the sun's area that's covered by the moon. So a lot of times people talk about them as if they're the same thing, but one has to do, magnitude has to do with diameter. Obscuration has to do with area. So they are different. If you look at numbers, you will see different numbers, but it's usually expressed as a percentage. So obviously the larger the percentage, the more it is obscured or occulted. That's the word NASA likes to use. And then two more great terms. Greatest eclipse. Have you guys heard this?
No. What's that?
So the greatest eclipse, you'll sometimes see it as a capital GE. It's the instant when the axis of the moon's shadow passes closest to the Earth's center. So this has to do a little bit more with where you are. The computation of the duration of the total phase or the annular phase, depending on the type of eclipse, at this point is typically done using a smooth edge for the moon that ignores the effects of mountains and valleys along the lunar limb. So, of course, they're going to do some calculations to make the moon as round as possible. The instant of the greatest eclipse offers a good approximation to the greatest duration of totality along the eclipse path. So they actually use this to calculate all those wonderful maps that everybody's looking at. But the greatest duration, which is often capitalized or identified as GD, which makes me quite happy, the GD eclipse, the GD of the eclipse, I should say, is that point in time when the length of the phase, whether it's the total phase or the annular phase, in this case, it's going to be the total phase, reaches a maximum along the central path of the eclipse. And so you can actually find the greatest duration on a map. That is when it's going to last the longest. The greatest eclipse is going to be the point where it's the largest because the center axis of the moon's shadow is right there over, over the Earth. So it's like perfectly aligned. And then lastly, we have to talk about Saros. Do you guys know about Saros?
Spell that, please.
S-A-R-O-S. Of course, if we were in England or if we were in Australia, we might be saying Saros. So this is awesome. The Saros cycle is a period of 6,585.3 days.
Right.
We can translate that to 18 years, 11 days. Yep, and 8 hours. And these are eclipse cycles. They're separated by this period. We call the period one Saros. And they will have a similar geometry. So every 18 years, 11 days, and 8 hours, that's the periodicity of this eclipse cycle. So you can actually see a similar eclipse that often. And each series lasts about 12 or 13 centuries and has about 70 or so eclipses. So that's really cool, right?
That's cool. Great. Talk about a big
picture. It's great that they can measure all that.
Right? It's insane. And it's not just for solar eclipses. That's also the case for lunar eclipses, which is very cool. So I did want to take a second, because we always talk about etymology, to actually look at the etymology of the word eclipse itself. And eclipse is from the 12th century when it first was used as the term eclipse, which is an old French term. But that, of course, came from the Latin eclipsis, which came from the Greek eclipsis. Who knows? Might have been pronounced eclipsis also, but it's spelled E-K-L-E-I-P-S-I-S.
And that came from the French. Ha, ha, ha.
Ha, ha. Nope. Ended with Greek, actually. But if we do break down the Greek, it was eclipsis actually came from eclepen, which meant to forsake a usual place, to fail to appear, or to be eclipsed, which is how we use it now. And you can actually break that down. Ek, which is kind of like X, is the first syllable there. And lepen is to leave. So it really ultimately evolved into an abandonment, a failing, a forsaking, and a darkness, which is how we use it today.
Nice.
Beautiful. And also, keep in mind, if you're trying to reproduce the umbra and penumbra at home, it's going to be difficult because if you're using a flashlight, it's going to be a point source. And the sun is not a point source. The sun is a diffuse source of light, which is why you can get something like a shadow that's smaller than the object. Some flat earthers are claiming that no matter how much they try, they can't make a shadow smaller than the object. But no, because you're using a point source of light. Please learn some, you know, optics and physics.
So if we were using a globe, like a globe, you know, they sell those glowing moon spheres or these glowing spheres.
Yes.
Could you make one that way?
The Yes, that's what you would need. I'm not sure the actual scale and the distances involved, but yes, you would need a diffuse source of light in order to replicate the umbra and the shadows.
Well, aren't you smart, Bob?
Kara,
yes.
Kara, do you know what an ischemic penumbra is?
Ischemia is a lack of oxygen, isn't it?
Yes. So what's the ischemic penumbra?
It's when the penumbra, when the shadow is...
On the moon.
Oh, is it have to do
seeing
with the moon?
Seeing it from the moon.
Oh, when you see it from the moon because there's less... No, that can't
that was my guess. That was
is it?
Guess.
Okay, when I think of ischemia, ischemia is a lack of oxygen.
Term.
Oh, it is a neurological term. Okay, so a penumbra in the... it's a shadow in the brain.
Oh, that
is it like a
good.
Shadow that happened... Well,
All right, let me tell you.
Oh, is it on film?
I won't
film?
Torture you anymore.
Oh my gosh, no. I'm so excited. Okay.
So, if you have a stroke, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And if the stroke is bad enough, there'll be a core of dead brain tissue, like basically in the vascular territory. But they'll surrounding the core of dead brain cells will be ischemic brain cells that are not dead, but they had a relative lack of oxygen. So that's the ischemic penumbra. It's the stunned brain cells around the dead brain cells, and it's just like an umbra and a penumbra, you know?
Fascinating.
Like
so you have
the
this
shadow
core.
Of death.
It's yeah, you probably have death. This core Ooh. Of like necrotic tissue,
exactly.
And then around it, there's some that's doing apoptosis and some that's struggling to survive.
And the ischemic penumbra, penumbra is much bigger volume-wise than the core because just geometry, right?
Because that's the umbra.
There's going to be a lot more brain cells in the ischemic penumbra. And so when we manage somebody who just has an acute stroke, that's what we're trying to do, basically, is save the brain cells in the ischemic penumbra.
Awesome. It's so, and that's it's so important to remember that so many things, you know, the brains are so well connected that it's not just the one area of damage, but there's this cascade of stuff around it that can go bad. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. So yeah, I like when one term gets used in to conceptually mean something similar, but in a different context, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very interesting. All right, cool.
I like it.
Jay, you're going to start us off on the news items. I love this. This is a really cool item about concrete gravity trains.
Wow.
Yeah, before I start, I want to say human innovation is one of the things that just makes our minds amazing, right? That we can conceptually come up with an idea that didn't exist before and then bring it into reality. That is really profound. Now, this idea isn't, you know, what I would consider to be... on an epic scale, but it is a really cool thing. And once I tell you, I think you're going to go, why didn't I think of that? Which I think is another cool phenomenon that happens when you hear a very good idea, you get a sense of, oh, that's obvious. Why didn't I think of that? So the backstory here is that energy grids need to always have a supply of electricity to meet all of human demand. And any spikes in demand, right? Like, you know, during the day when we're all at work and all those big buildings have the lights on and the machines are running and all that. If there is too much of a demand, meaning that the grid can't supply all the power that is being pulled from the grid, we can get a brownout or you can actually get a complete drop in power. And the companies that produce electricity, they also don't want to have production go too far when they in a low demand phase. They don't want to be spending a lot of money making electricity that isn't going to be used. So what they try to do is they try to match production to power the grid inside the grid's peaks and valleys, right? It's just that's the most economical way that they can produce electricity and distribute the electricity. They're not going to be having generators pumping out electricity at 3 a.m. when no one's asking for it. So one way to solve this load balancing problem on the grid is to store energy when the demand for power is down or low. And let me start that sentence over here. We don't have massive batteries that can do this. We really don't have like grid batteries that can store months of electricity. That doesn't exist. So engineers have had to come up with interesting ways to work around this idea that we don't have real batteries to store power.
Although to be clear, you don't need to store months of energy in a grid battery system. If you had even one day of energy, that would be enough to load balance.
Oh,
that'd even
be,
less.
Yeah, you're right, Steve.
Any amount of energy would load balance, right? I mean, you're basically shaving off peaks, and so anything is helpful.
Exactly. So they've come up with ideas like the hydroelectric storage dams that are used today. So these are pretty interesting. This is a great idea. These are thought to be called physical batteries because water is pumped from a lower elevation to a higher elevation. And typically they're pumping the water, say, from a river or some water source into a reservoir that is higher than the river. You can bring the water back down to whatever pipes that they have. They can generate electricity and they can distribute that in the grid when they need to. So there are a number of locations that have these hydroelectric storage facilities, but they're limited because we literally need there to be these perfect geographical locations that have a water source and a reservoir for the water, and then of course the right distance and all the physics have to be right in order for these to work. And we're limited; we can't really just create those. We have to find locations that fit the bill. So, a company in California has developed a new solution that uses the same concept of the water that I just described for potential energy, and it's called the Advanced Rail Energy Storage System, or ARES. And they've created a land-based train that very simply stores potential energy by making the train climb up the slope during low energy demand times, right? So the train has these giant concrete blocks on it that weigh 300 tons or 272 metric tons, massively heavy. Of course, that weight is very hard to push up a slope, but they use the current electricity that's available in the grid to slowly push that weight up the slope during lower demand. And once it's at the top of the slope, they leave it there until high demand comes around, and then they let that train go back down the slope, right? So it has potential energy that they'll transfer into kinetic energy. The train comes back down the slope, generates energy during that process of gravity pulling it slowly down the slope. That lasts about 8 hours. It's 80% efficient, which is great.
Good. Pumped hydro, that's as good as pumped hydro, about 80% efficient.
And there are a few details. It can deliver 50 megawatts of power, and it only needs a 7.2% grade. Actually, 7.2% is what they designed it to be optimal. And they're using, it's very simple, guys, and we've already heard of this. You ever hear of electric cars that they pull energy when it brakes?
Oh, yeah.
Regenerative braking.
Yeah, it's regenerative braking. Regenerative.
Regenerative braking.
It's called regenerative braking.
No, guys, it's called regenerative braking. So,
okay. Thanks.
So they simply use that system to generate power inside the chassis of the train. And there you have it. It doesn't need to be that long. Like they only need it to be 268 meters. Like they have a test track right now. It's 278 meters. But they will build a track that's much bigger than that. But it's not that hard to achieve a 7.2% grade on land. You know, this isn't, doing very complicated and expensive things like moving. I can't even tell you how many tons of water that they're moving or the volume of water that they would move to generate what amount of electricity. This is just a track that a city can store somewhere in the periphery of a city or around a town or whatever, that it just doesn't have to take up that much space. And it's a very inexpensive thing. It's actually half as expensive as the least expensive source of electricity or way of storing or generating electricity. This is half as expensive as the next best one. Nevada is already interested, showing a very strong interest in buying the technology and deploying it. So I really think this is a no-brainer. This isn't 5 years off. This is right now. The company has developed the technology. They're optimizing it. They're scaling it, and they're going to bring it out. And we're going to see this around. I bet you that this technology will be used around the world for on-demand energy.
It's pretty fascinating. I love the idea. I also love how it requires no external input like fuel or water at all. It just operates purely from energy coming from the grid, which is fantastic. The one thing though is that it says here that this can be implemented, like you said, Jay, for half the cost of the cheapest electrical energy storage system, and that's great. But I mean, how long is that statistic going to stay? I mean, that's going to change. Then it'll be, only 25% better, then only 5% better. Eventually, I think it's only a matter of time before we will be able to store them off, in some sort of storage system, electrical storage system. And when that happens, there's going to be no comparison because you need miles. You need many, many kilometers of rail for this to work. It does take up a lot of space. You need that space nearby in order to implement this, whereas a battery, could fill a building, and enough batteries could just fill a building and you're done. But still, this is a great idea.
Yeah, but they have a terrible efficiency, and they don't last that long. And then you have to, they have toxic, components to them. We don't want to have a massive battery storage solution with our current battery tech, period. It's just not really a good way to go. I think we really need you know, we need a grid battery storage solution, which we do not have at this point. So I don't think there's going to be any one solution that's going to be like, oh, we're going to do – this is what we're doing now for everything. I think we need different options that are optimal in different situations. Like pumped hydro is great if you have the water.
Yep.
If you're in Nevada, pumped hydro is terrible. In hot, dry environments, you lose a lot of the energy to evaporation. So that's not ideal there either. But this requires, as you say, a long track of the right grade. And so, and actually warmer temperatures are beneficial to regenerative braking efficiency. So Nevada is like the perfect place for it. Yeah. But you need the physical location where you could put it. I wonder how many cars they could put on one track. Is there a limit to like how much energy like the one track can generate? Or
Well, Steve. So, you know, that's a really cool question. I didn't think about that. I would imagine that there's diminishing returns because if the track – think about it, the more cars you put on the track, the shorter the track gets. You understand?
Well, even if you keep the track length the same, I'm just saying I wonder if – because that electricity that it's generating has got to be going to the grid. That pipeline, I think, is limited. But maybe they maybe it doesn't have – whatever. Maybe they could have scale that up. In other words, they won't necessarily have to build 10 tracks. They just build one track with 10 times the bandwidth and 10 of these cars on it, you know.
Or make them heavier.
I don't know how –
500 tons.
Yeah, make them out of lead. I don't know. I don't know if what – how it could scale. How would you optimally scale it without necessarily just building a lot of different tracks? I also, when I, because I had sort of thought of this idea previously, but not the track idea.
Sure
I thought,
did.
No, I, my, what, my thought was you take like a heavy lead weight and you literally lift it vertically and then, and then you let it drop when you need the energy back.
Like
right?
a grandfather clock.
So exactly. So, I wonder if that seems like just an engineering problem, you know, but I wonder if you can get to the same kind of efficiency with it, with something that would work that way. That way it doesn't take up a lot of space if it's all vertical, you know, and if you use something super heavy like lead weights, it wouldn't have to be that big.
Yeah. You want to hear something funny, guys? You know what drives me nuts? Mm-hmm. I think I've said this before on the show.
A ship's wheel.
It's driving me nuts.
You can't blow the best pirate joke by telling the punchline. I mean, that's not right, man.
Some jokes, yeah, but some jokes are so well known, all you got to do is the punchline.
That's right.
There's really only three pirate jokes in existence. I mean, so everyone knows it.
I still feel bad about that. All right, I probably have said this before, but you know, you think about all the solar radiation hitting the planet and how little of it we're collecting, right?
That's the ultimate.
And we're going to start collecting a lot more. We might even be putting things in orbit to collect that energy and all that. But the thing that really bothers me, and I'm not just saying this to be funny. It's true. Like I ponder this at night when I can't sleep, is all the solar radiation that is just being completely wasted. That's not hitting the Earth. It's going into deep space, going nowhere. Doing
Dyson
no good
swarm,
for anybody.
Baby. Two words.
Exactly.
Dyson swarm.
We'll never see that, but. I mean, imagine if we had a thing maybe the size of the moon or maybe the moon itself or whatever that's just an array of solar panels that's trailing the Earth in its orbit or whatever. I know that you can't do
that. Wait, but why does it bug you that we're having all that there's so much excess solar energy out there when we're not even harnessing the solar energy that actually is hitting us?
It all bothers me. It's all a waste.
I think I love to recommend documentaries anytime that I have a chance because I'm an avid documentary watcher. And if you guys haven't seen the new Inconvenient Truth, it's called An Inconvenient Sequel.
Oh, haven't
it literally
seen
just came out. It's fabulous. And Al Gore does a really good job of talking about some of the logistics and the mathematics behind harnessing all that solar energy. And he does this really cool thing where he shows year by year the increase in the processing power that we have in this solar energy. And it's exponential. Like, we're already so much better at this than we used to be. And eventually, I think we could just live off of what's coming from the sun.
I hope so. That would be nice.
That would be amazing.
It's just a matter of when. It's inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable. It's the most obvious. It's just...
will it be in time? That's the thing.
Yeah, it's like had to be there. You know, the investments had to be there and the technology had to be there. And at least now, it seems like the technology kind of is there. It's just really it's the will and the investment. But it's getting cheaper cheaper.
All right. It's all very cool. But let's move on. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard of the backfire effect?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep. Familiar with it?
Oh, yes.
It's basically the notion that when you try to change somebody's mind, they dig in their heels and believe in nonsense even stronger.
It happens more often than we even think.
Yeah, it's the skeptic's worst nightmare. But really, it's like, you know, we're trying to spread science and critical thinking, and it makes people believe nonsense even more fervently.
Yeah.
Okay. You know. Although it's not actually, when the studies started coming out showing the backfire effect, I think it was overplayed. I think people were saying like, oh, everyone digs in their heels and there's no benefit. But it's actually still a little controversial what the magnitude of the effect is and in what situations do we see it. And there's multiple things going on here. It's not all a digging in of the heels effect. Just memory itself is playing a role. So, all right, there was a new study which shows unfortunately confirms some elements of the backfire effect. But let's give it back up for a little bit of background. Psychologists have determined that people follow basically a Bayesian approach to knowledge, which means that you have beliefs. When you get new facts, you incorporate them into your existing beliefs and you update your beliefs. Right? That's the Bayesian approach.
It's a good approach.
It's a good approach. It'd be nice if we did that all the time in all contexts, but we don't. You know, we don't always update our beliefs. The question is, why don't we always do that? So one factor is that, well, first, it takes a lot of work, and people just instinctively avoid work, even mental work. Beliefs have inertia. Confirmation bias is we tend to stick with what we already believe. There's also desirability bias, which I think we talked about before, where we believe what we want to be true and the facts be damned. And then we have our narratives, our ideology, and we tend to, is the more we identify with a belief system, with a narrative, and the more it is part of our worldview and our conception of how things work and our place in the world, the more likely we are to dig in our heels and to not update our beliefs regardless of the evidence. So there is a backfire effect, but the question is, under what situations does it manifest, and how significant is it? Is it really just extreme cases, or is it for everyday things? And I think that's still largely an unresolved issue, because different studies show different things. So not everything has been consistently replicating. But let's get to the new study. This one looks at, and this has been a common paradigm for backfire effect studies, they looked at changing views of vaccines, because that's just a big issue out there in the population. And they're also testing different ways of changing people's minds, right? So they exposed people to different types of information to see if they could reduce belief that vaccines are unsafe, or specifically that vaccines are associated with autism. So one method of communication was to have fact versus myth side by side. This is the myth. Vaccines are associated with autism. Here's the facts. Scientific studies show there's no correlation. Right? That's just the fact versus myth approach, which I think is kind of the basic approach that skeptics take. That's kind of our go-to default. Now, this is a myth. Here's the truth. Here's the scientific studies. Here's the evidence. Right?
Yeah.
Although this is looking at sort of a public service announcement, you know, type of format. The second approach was to show information graphically rather than just in words, right? Like have a graph, you know, of the magnitude of like the number of people, you know, who get vaccines and how small, you know, the side effects are and how many people are saved from diseases. And then the third was basically the scared straight approach, which was, here are some pictures of kids with measles. You know, this is what happens when you don't vaccinate.
They're doing that with cigarettes. Like a lot of places have started doing that with cigarettes.
Graphic images,
Have we talked about the kids texting and driving and showing the accidents as well?
I think so. Yeah, I think we've mentioned that on the show.
We've mentioned that recently.
Yeah. It doesn't work that well, though, the whole scare
straight.
Well,
yeah, it seemed like I seem to remember a finding that with cigarettes, it didn't really prevent people who already were smoking from continuing smoking. They would just like look past it. But it might have had some preventive effect for individuals who had never started smoking.
But it's hard to get people to change their behavior, even with fear.
Absolutely.
Then they had a fourth group, which had unrelated information. That was the control group. So guess what they found?
No difference.
No difference for any of the three interventions.
Right.
So none of them worked at all in this study. Now, there have been previous studies. Some show an effect. Some show a limited or no effect. So this is one new study. It's not definitive. It's just, you know, unfortunately, it had a bad outcome.
Well, I'm depressed.
The other thing you could look at, well, so you have to ask, too, it's like, well, what effect were you going for? So how do you measure, was there an effect? One way to measure it is to just immediately ask them, now, what do you think about vaccines? How do you think vaccines are safe? But then you can also ask them to see if there's a delayed effect. You could say you bring them back in a week or 10 days or whatever, and then survey their attitudes about vaccines. What this found is that none of the interventions had an immediate benefit, reduced negative attitudes about vaccines. But for the group of people who already had very negative views about vaccines, a week later, they had even more negative views about vaccines. So the dedicated anti-vaxxers had a backfire effect that is somewhat consistent with previous studies, that it's the real ideologues who get the backfire effect. And for the other groups who didn't already have negative views, there was no benefit but no real backfire effect.
Okay.
The limitations of this study. This one study is not definitive. One is that these are all college students.
Common study limitation.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's a sample of convenience. You know, because of a captive audience. For
hey, kid, get over here.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. You want credit for this class? Get in this study. Yeah.
Bring your friend here too.
And then the second is that they didn't actually survey their intention to vaccinate, just their attitudes about vaccination. And actually, the outcome you'd really want to know is, do they actually vaccinate, like actual vaccination rates? That would be the best, right? Because that's the ultimate goal, right, is to improve vaccination rates. So
the students, I hope they are all vaccinated.
Well, yeah, not the anti-vaxxers, apparently. So, so this is sort of consistent with kind of what's been shown before, though, again, there's some conflicting results. I think my best summary of all the studies that I've read so far is that there's probably a backfire effect for people who have a strong ideological or narrative beliefs tied up with their worldview and their identity. Mm-hmm. Or tribalism. I think we have to mention tribalism. It's really hard to change people's minds with fear-based information, with just like, you know, fact-based information, unless they're already willing to have their mind changed, you know?
Yeah.
I think that the big limitation is that you're going to, you know, highly educated students, you know, they're in college with kind of a public service announcement, kind of piecemeal information. And it also, it's just one intervention. And so I think one thing that we've learned over the years as skeptics, you're not going to get much benefit out of one intervention. You need to work with people over time.
Yes. Over time.
It needs to be interactive. You need to deal with their questions and their concerns and their pushback. And it takes time. I'm not discouraged in that. I really didn't have high hopes that one PSA was going to change their minds anyway.
Right.
So, yeah. We already kind of knew. It's like, yeah, you're in. If you want to actually change people's minds, you're in for the long haul. You need to spend some time with them. So this is consistent with that, but it's unfortunate that, you know, basically humans are irrational. We have just a lot of, I think we're intellectually lazy at baseline. You have to make a conscious effort to say, okay, I really want, and people do want their beliefs to be truth-based. They want them to be factual, but that's competing with a lot of other biases and concerns as well. We just need people to really value that the most. It's like, oh, I really need what I believe to be accurate. So if I'm getting some conflicting information, I gotta, you know, set my current beliefs aside. First of all, you should always hold lightly to your current beliefs. Don't identify with them. Don't, you know, don't make it part of your worldview or your identity, some factual claim that could be overturned tomorrow. Because when new facts come to light, you have to go, damn, all right, well, there you go. I got to change my mind. You know, you just have to have that attitude. But that in and of itself has to be cultivated.
What about holding on to your beliefs that you shouldn't hold on to your beliefs?
Yeah.
Except that one.
Very meta, Bob.
Convince me otherwise, you know, what can I tell you?
Logic loop.
That's Perry-esque.
Yeah. I wrote recently about, because there's an article that used the term tribal epistemology. which I hadn't heard before. I like cool terms like that. So epistemology is how we know what we know. And basically what the article was about was that tribal epistemology is when people believe whatever facts are in line with their tribe. That's it. If my tribe is saying it and supports it, it's true. If the other tribe is saying it, it's fake news, right? Where have we heard that? So,
oh gosh.
And their point was that that's really what's been happening recently. This is all old. It's been going on forever, but it seems like there's a relative increase in tribal epistemology. You know,
and awareness that is spreading among people that this is happening.
Yeah, and hopefully there'll be a backlash. We'll see.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on. Evan, you're going to tell us how to make polio vaccines out of tobacco.
This news comes to us courtesy of the John Innes Center, Norwich, United Kingdom. Plants have been used to produce a new vaccine against poliovirus. And they're hoping it's a major step towards global eradication of the disease, finally.
Oh, we're so close.
Oh, gosh, we are close. We've got it down. We've got it down. But the methods we're using now still allow for the disease to linger in a diluted sort of form. But this might go this might be able to put us over the edge or over that hurdle.
But let me clarify just to be clear. We could eradicate polio with our current vaccines. Absolutely. And we came very close. It was really just vaccine refusal because of fear-mongering and pseudoscience that stopped us. It should have already been eradicated.
Well, yeah. So, and at this point, we are very close. There's only like... I can't remember the number, but I think it's only in the...
So here are the numbers. So in 2016, the total was 37 cases of the wild poliovirus worldwide and 5 cases of the vaccine-derived poliovirus worldwide. Year-to-date in 2017, there have only been 9 cases of the wild poliovirus, but there have been 40 cases of the vaccine-derived poliovirus. That doesn't mean that they necessarily got it from the vaccine, but that's the form of the virus that people came down with, the one that derived ultimately from the one used in the vaccine.
That's right. And that's why this news hopefully will lend promise that it will be a cheap, efficient, and method that is accessible all over the world, basically. Mm. And we can nail this last fraction of a percent. So scientists have produced a novel vaccine with a method that uses virus-like particles, VLPs. These are non-pathogenic mimics of poliovirus, which are grown in plants, specifically a relative of the tobacco plant in this case. Genes that carry information to produce VLPs are infiltrated into the plant tissues. Then the host plant reproduces large quantities of them using its own protein expression mechanisms. So the VLPs, they look like viruses, but they're non-infectious.
Infectious?
Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I like infectious.
Infectious, that's all. That's like word. Thermical. That's like thermal.
Geothermal.
Wow, Kara, you really like that word, don't you?
It's so fun to say. It's like testicles.
Testicles.
All right, now we did it. Now we got to create a list.
Viruses.
I know, okay. We need a list. I'm going to start it right now.
A list, hell of a book. They biologically engineer these so they do not contain the nucleic acid that allows viruses to replicate. So they mimic the behavior of the virus, which in turn stimulates an immune system to respond without causing an infection of, in this case, poliomyelitis. So far, the research has been successful in animals, cute little furry white animals, and hopefully human trials are not too far off in the distant future. The WHO, that's the World Health Organization, they're seeking alternative vaccines that could avoid the use of the live virus as part of an international drive to completely eradicate the virus from all parts of the world. And the current polio vaccines require huge quantities of the virus in order to make the vaccines. And using the live virus represents a risk of the virus escaping. But the use of live attenuated virus effectively maintains polio in the global population, which is what we were alluding to earlier.
Yeah, and by the way, so I mean, it may seem weird that we're using the tobacco plant, but tobacco plant is a very well understood, you know, scientifically understood plant. I think we've sequenced at least 3 varieties, you know, in terms of the genomes. So mm-hmm. it is used a lot in research just because it's very thoroughly characterized. We understand it very well.
Yeah.
And Bob, we're going to go from that to maybe a new potential for combating antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, researchers have created a promising new approach to killing bacteria. Instead of poisoning them from within, like conventional antibiotics, they can literally rip their cell walls apart. So now this is from a research team at the University of Melbourne, led by graduate student Shu Lam. This news item actually came out a little while ago, but we hadn't mentioned it. And I see that this could be pretty critical in the near future. So I definitely wanted to cover this. So now we've talked about the decrease in antibiotic effectiveness for years now on the show. And it's just one of those scary scenarios that every day becomes increasingly more likely. And it's just so scary. But I found a quote by Sir Alexander Fleming, who discovered the first antibiotic in 1928. And he actually said this in his Nobel Prize lecture. He said, "It's not difficult to make microbes resistant to penicillin in a laboratory by exposing them to concentrations not sufficient to kill them. There is the danger that the ignorant man may easily underdose himself and by exposing his microbes to non-lethal quantities of the drug make them resistant." So today he would be saying, "See, I told you assholes 90 years ago." 90 years ago, this guy is predicting that what could happen, and now it's getting staggeringly bad. I mean, guess how many people die from antibiotic-resistant bacteria each year?
Six.
Wow. 5,000.
Well, probably a lot, because a lot of things are resistant to one antibiotic, but you can still take another antibiotic.
Exactly. Typically, you have recourse, but
these people died, so obviously
right,
they didn't
do that. Die. So, all right, the number is 700,000. 700,000 people,
yeah,
which is a lot larger than
I thought.
Wait,
did you say, is that worldwide or is that U.S.?
They
I figured.
Yeah.
It's probably low in the U.S.
But it's getting bigger. So the number, and that number is expected to reach a staggering 50 million people dead every year in 2050. Jeez. 50 wow. million people in 2050. And I think 2030, 40, 50, that's right around the time they anticipate that there'll be more people dying from infections than cancer. So, yeah. And
so it'll
be
like it was 300 years ago.
Yeah, well, yeah.
All over
again. A pre-antibiotic era. Absolutely. Ugh. So basically what we're talking about is superbugs that are resistant to all antibiotics, and it's actually happening. The CDC thinks that gonorrhea is actually close to attaining superbug status because antibiotic resistant bacteria have reduced the five treatment options that gonorrhea used to have down to one. So you think, all right, we'll just make new antibiotics, right? Well, that makes a lot of sense, but there's only actually been a couple of new approved antibiotics in decades, going back decades. And so what we need are more arrows in our quiver. But the thing is, we need different arrows. We don't need a lot of the same arrows. We need lots of different arrows. And how about one with the equivalent of an explosive tip? This is kind of like
Rambo 2,
you got
First
it.
Blood. Yeah.
those scenes were so awesome. So yes, this is kind of what we're talking about. This is kind of what this new bacteria killer is like. It doesn't kill like antibiotics by poisoning them from the inside out. It does different things to them, like I said earlier, ripping the cell wall apart. So these are called SNAPs, structurally nano-engineered antimicrobial peptide polymers. Nano baby. So these are essentially short. Come on. These are short chains of proteins called peptide polymers. They're star shaped and they take no prisoners. These things are impressive. So even if the SNAP concentrations are low, what they do is they injure the bacteria so much that they trigger apoptosis or Kara, you actually used that word earlier in the show,
program
cell death. So the microbial cell basically says it. But if the concentrations are high, then the destruction of the outer and the cytoplasmic membranes are so dramatic that they die even before apoptosis can be triggered. So that just wipes them out. So far they've tested this in vitro and in vivo, and it's totally dominated. The in vivo test infected mice with this colistin-resistant microbe. Half of the mice in the control and the antibiotic group died. So, you know, you need different groups. The two groups that didn't get the SNAP died, or 50, half of them did. The group that got the snaps all survived, and they all showed greatly minimized infections. So it really did surprisingly well. They're incredibly excited about this. And despite even all that awesomeness, there's two more icings on this cake. One is that these peptides do not harm our healthy cells because they're just basically too big to interface with them. So that's good. It only targets the cells that you want specifically, and it ignores human cells. I mean, even our antibiotics today in certain situations can mess with the bacteria in your gut and other stuff, and or even harm cells, some healthy cells. So even they are not risk free in that regard. And the other awesome thing is, get this one, blew me away. The bacteria seem to be not able to figure out how to defend or how to evolve against these snaps, these peptides. They actually tested the efficacy of snaps over 600 generations of bacteria, one generation after another, and the latest generation died just as easily as their ancestors did, which is amazing, because that's the problem with bacteria. They breed so quickly. They are able to adapt to poison so well that's why we're in this problem that we're in right now. But over 600 generations, no apparent difference at all. And they theorize that that's because one reason is because these snaps have so many different ways, not just the cell wall, but they have so many different ways of actually killing the cell that they just can't adapt to it at all. And, but the only real method of attack that these articles are talking about, and the article in I think it was in Nature, was the fact that it just devastates the cell wall. So I'm not even sure what some of the other things that this antibiotic does. So I hope this works out. We desperately need it, but as usual, we're at the earliest stage of development. And even if this pans out and continues to work this well in humans, you won't see this in the pharmacy for years. So just,
what, 5-10 years?
God, who knows?
All right, Kara, this one is near and dear to my heart. Alternative medicine will kill you.
It's true. I mean, we've known it for a long time, so I don't think that this news item is going to surprise anybody, but there is a new study. It's actually a communication that was just published on the internet in advance of the paper publication in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, called Use of Alternative Medicine for Cancer and Its Impacts on Survival. And
some of my homies at Yale.
I was going to say, yeah, do you know these guys?
No.
Oh, okay.
You think I know everybody at Yale?
Yeah, I just assume.
Do you call them homies, for real?
Homie. So yeah, the lead author on this is Skylar B. Johnson, and he had three co-authors on this, Henry Park, Carrie Gross, and James Yu, and they hail from the Department of Therapeutic Radiology at Yale, which I think is kind of a fancy word for oncology, maybe? But maybe radiology you can use to treat
other things. No, it's therapeutic radiation. Radiation oncology.
Yeah, radiation therapy.
I think
exactly.
It used to be radiation oncology, but I think that this is because they do other stuff other than oncology, so it's a less specific term, just therapeutic radiation. Yeah.
Makes sense. And so, of course, these physicians are used to treating patients who have cancer, and they wanted to know what happens when people who have a cancer diagnosis opt to have alternative cancer treatment instead of treatments that we know work. Mm-hmm. Like, they use a specific, what do you call it?
Acronym.
Oh, acronym.
Acronym. Oh, my God. They use a specific acronym. They call it conventional cancer treatment, CCT. They use that throughout the paper.
That's actually not an acronym. It's initialism.
Thank you, Bob. That makes me feel less like I had a giant brain lapse.
Because you can't pronounce it.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah, there you go. It's an initialism, conventional cancer treatment. So that would be things like radiation, chemotherapy, targeted hormone therapy, things of that nature. And what they did is they looked through a database where a lot of oncologists put in data, specific data on cancer patients, one of the more reliable databases that exist out there. And they wanted to look through and find as many people as they could who decided not to have conventional cancer treatment, which was not that easy because they had a few exclusion criteria. Like, they didn't want people who were stage 4 or people whose cancer had already metastasized. And they also didn't want to pick obscure cancers or cancers with really, really high mortality, like pancreatic cancer. So they went for the four most common types of cancer: breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. And they chose individuals who had non-metastatic forms of that and who did not receive conventional cancer treatment. The way that they were able to find that is that in the database, there are certain ways that doctors might code. One of them is some sort of code for the patient seeked, quote, other dash unproven. That's cancer treatments administered by non-medical personnel. And the other, and so they had to both have been coded as other unproven cancer treatments administered by non-medical personnel, and they had to have not had anything in their record at that time saying that they had conventional cancer treatment. Oh, and they define that as chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, and or hormone therapy. So after they excluded all of that, they found only 281 patients that matched that criteria. And then they did matched groups. Of course, they couldn't do a true experimental method. That would be completely unethical. So they just took that and they did a 2-to-1 matching. So they found 560 patients that had had conventional cancer treatments who they matched on a lot of different indicators like age and comorbidity and other things so that they could try and you know, tease out, is it the alternative therapy or the non-alternative therapy that we are actually looking at? They did a bunch of statistical analysis and they came up with, surprise, the fact that if you take alternative therapy and you don't get true functional cancer treatment, you are more likely to die. And here are the outcomes that they actually found. Among those with breast cancer, people taking alternative remedies were 5.68 times more likely to die within 5 years. For those with lung cancer, 41% who got conventional treatment survived 5 years, but only 20% who opted out did. And then the colorectal cancer was pretty extreme. Only 33% of people using alternative medicine survived for 5 years. 79% who had conventional treatment survived for 5 years. Now, they didn't find a significant difference in individuals who had prostate cancer, but the researchers say that this is likely because prostate cancer has a really, really long life. Like, most people don't decline very quickly when they're first diagnosed. Prostate cancer is highly survivable, as we all know, but you often don't decline that quickly. So it could be the case that there was no significant difference because they didn't look long enough. And also, there are some limitations to the study. They weren't able to see if people got secondary treatment later because that wasn't indicated in the database data that they used. So it was obviously exactly what we would expect. This is not a new finding, but it's a really clean finding. David Gorski wrote about this on Science Based Medicine. It's a good write-up called Alternative Medicine Kills Cancer Patients. Very clear headline there. And he actually goes deeper into the study and points to other studies that have shown similar outcomes. The studies are pretty rare, and so that's why it's important that we look at all of the good kind of science-based data out there, the real statistics, so that we can understand the difference. I mean, it's an obvious outcome, but it is one that we still need to back by data.
It is an extra burden that people face now when you have a serious illness, is that everyone comes out of the woodwork and thinks that it's their job to recommend that you use nonsense to treat your real medical problem. It's amazing. And people, absolutely, a lot of people have described to me what an additional emotional burden that is. You know, they're made to feel guilty, you know, they're shamed for not doing it. They're, you know, they're really put, a lot of pressure is put upon them. And then, and you, it's a very difficult situation to be in, because if you respond with what you really think, you're insulting them. You know,
yeah, but
you,
absolutely.
So now you suddenly have to figure out a way of telling people that you're really not interested without insulting their belief system, but really they're just, you know, burdening you at a time when you're ill and they should just mind their own effing business anyway because they're not, you know, professionals who have no idea what they're talking about. It's just crazy.
Absolutely. And we just think about the culture of the language. We talk about people who live as cancer survivors, but we talk about people who die as cancer victims.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it's just a thing. Yeah. And so I think it's really cool when we have these. There was some athlete who was pretty outspoken about it, not here in the United States, but when we have these people who have cancer and people go, oh, you're a survivor. Oh, you worked so hard. And they're like, I just did what my doctor told me to do.
Right.
Like, I'm just lucky. That's really all I did.
Yeah. My wife had breast cancer, and recently, you know, John McCain, it was made public that he was diagnosed with brain cancer, which is terrible. And all of the media was like, yeah, but he's a tough guy. He's a strong guy. He's a fighter. And she was like, that's insulting bullshit.
It is.
It is.
It's not like he's not going to fight off this cancer. The medicine will do what it can do. And that's it.
Yep.
But people don't like that. They want to think, oh, if you're strong-willed, you could fight after cancer. No, you can't.
No, you can't control your cells.
It has nothing to do with that.
You can't control your cells.
Yeah, you're not fighting. You're not like telling your cells to fight the cancer cells. It doesn't.
No. And then that spreads over into our view of psychiatry really heavily. Yeah, sure. So then all of a sudden, all of these psychiatric illnesses are illnesses
you're weak.
Of will.
You're weak.
It's horrible. And like John McCain, bless his heart, he's elderly. He's going to have a harder go than people who have, you know, are younger.
What if people choose quality of life over quantity? What if they say, you know what? I don't want to fight it. I want to be comfortable and enjoy my final days. And, you know, are we supposed to shame them now into fighting because that's what you have to do to survive?
Ugh. I know. It's just crazy.
Steve, does your mental attitude even have an effect on the outcome of
not death.
Not death. Yeah, there's a lot of studies that show that, you know, no matter what you think about it. But what it can have an outcome on is your quality of life as you are dying, you know. So having that undue pressure can be really negative.
All right, Jay, before you do Who's That Noisy, I think you have the results of the QED contest.
Well, 2 weeks ago, we announced a contest on the podcast to win tickets to go to QED. And in case you don't know, QED, Question, Explore, Discover, it's a two-day science and skepticism convention conference taking place at the Mercure Piccadilly Hotel in Manchester from the 14th to the 15th of October of this year. They have a really, really fun lineup. I suggest you go to qedcon.org. That's qedcon.org. If you haven't purchased a ticket, tickets are still available. But more importantly, someone emailed in with the name Michael Fenn. Michael won two tickets to go to QED.
Sweet.
Congratulations.
So Andy, who's one of the directors at the conference, told us that a lot of people that wrote in thought they were actually writing to us, the SGU, but those emails actually went directly to the board at QED. And Andy was like, yeah, a lot of people said a lot of nice things about you guys. I'm like, what, are you surprised? Like, what is this? So because of that, I'm going to also promise Michael Fenn that Andy's going to give him a back rub.
At the okay.
part of the prize.
It's not creepy at all.
Michael, right? Michael, you can just expect to be contacted by the board. They're going to send you a really cool email and explain to you how this is going to go down. So thank you all for everyone who sent the email in. Thank you. Everyone who didn't send the email in. Thank you. Steve, go screw yourself.
All right, Jay. All right, Jay, who's that noisy?
So last week I played this noisy.
Who saw you? She saw me. Whom did she see? She saw me. Did she see you or hear you? She saw me.
I just love that.
I know, right? What is it about it?
Who saw you? It's so taunting. She saw me. You know what I mean? It's like playful, you know?
Well, and it shows, you know, it's like a drama lesson that we used to take in school where if you put the emphasis on different syllables, you change the meaning of the sentences.
That's right. Yeah, that is fun. I remember doing that as a kid. All right. So what was that, guys?
A computer.
Robbie the Robot.
Yeah, AI or something.
An algorithm.
So that is something called the Voder.
I knew it.
Voice synthesis system. So Voder stands for Voice Operation Demonstrator.
And if it's really
that's
deep,
an actual acronym.
Yeah. Yes, right.
Yes, and the winner from last week was Paul D. Disney. He wrote in first and correctly. I did get quite a few people writing in. Thank you. I had a another person write in named Andrew Hansford who gave a very, very good description. So I thought I would give him a shout out because I'm going to read his description. He said it was the first electronically synthesized human speech invented by Homer Dudley at Bell Labs circa 1937 and 1938. It was demonstrated at the 1939 World's Fair. It worked by imitating the elements of the human vocal tract. It did require an operator to sequence, which kind of looked like someone playing the piano, but there weren't that many keys, to sequence the different elements using keys like an organ to produce words. I did some research on this thing, and it took an operator about a year to be able to produce the sound that you heard. The operator, I don't know why they were women, but that's the only people I saw operating it. But they had two different things that they were controlling, and it's a little complicated, to be honest with you. I read the details, but one of them was the breath, that it had a breath side of this, which I thought was fascinating. Like, wow, like they were actually controlling this idea of breath. And I suspect that the machine actually was blowing air. I'm not 100% sure because I couldn't find that much information. But either way, this thing is really cool, and it really astounded people that went and saw it demonstrated in person at the World's Fair. I really, really love this. So thanks again, Nathan Grange, for sending that in. That was a really fun one. So, would anybody like to guess this week's Noisy before I play it?
Before you play it?
It's
before you play it?
Before you play it?
It's before you play it.
Before you play
it's
it?
An otter playing a harmonica. Okay. Thank you.
This was sent in by a listener named Frederick Cassette.
I'm going to stick with a masturbating snail.
Yeah.
All right. What a great name, Frederick Cassette.
This one is really fun. And there is something about, I don't know if anyone deserves any clues. This might be really hard to guess, so let me play it, and then I'll think maybe I need to throw a clue out there. Take a listen to this. So, if you think you know what this week's Noisy is, or if you heard something really cool like the voter, then you can email me very easily at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jay. All right, one email from last week. We got some feedback on our discussion about the atheist study. I'm not going to read a specific email. We got a bunch of them, but essentially people thought we were a little harsh on the study. So it's fair enough. So I reread it, actually. I reread the entire thing, taking into consideration the feedback that we heard from various people. And in the end, I think that we were a little hard on it. I think it actually...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it was a little bit better than what we had given it credit for. Although I think they were sort of over-interpreting our negative feedback, and maybe we weren't qualifying it as much because people thought that I was a lot more negative than I actually thought I was coming off as. But essentially, the study used... They were trying to look for inherent bias in thinking that people who do not believe in God are less moral, right? So they used, you know, the conjunction bias, which we sort of made tangential mention of, but it was, they said, they basically describe a serial killer, then they say, is it more likely this guy was a teacher and religious, or was a teacher and did not believe in God or gods? And people were more likely in pretty much every country they tested, whether they were believers or not believers themselves, were more likely to say that it was more likely that the person was a teacher and did not believe in any gods. So they concluded from that reflected inherent bias against atheists, you know, the notion that atheists are inherently immoral. And so I you know, get the paradigm. I understand that. I think our criticism was that it's an indirect way of getting at that conclusion, and that introduces potential confounding factors, which I still think is a legitimate point. No one study is definitive. That's pretty much what we say about every psychological study. You know, you need to look at it three, four different ways. Also, just historically, because especially Kara and I, I'm sure we've read hundreds of these studies over decades. And, you know, we frequently read about subsequent studies which looked at the same question in different ways. Like, oh, it turns out that it's this other factor that we never thought of, you know. So it's more our, I think our criticisms, they weren't really criticisms. They were just generic observations about the limitations of these kinds of studies. You know what I'm saying? But I think that was interpreted as we thought that this wasn't a good study. Well, I think it was a fine study. And I actually think that I don't doubt the phenomenon. I think it's true that there's inherent bias against people who don't believe in gods. But the thing that but reading through it again, I think I just forgot or missed this the first time through. They didn't publish the data, but they had supplemental studies. So that was one of the things I was thinking. It's like, well, you really got to look at this a few different ways before you draw any conclusions. And they actually did do that. They looked at, to address potential methodological confounds, which is what we were talking about, they actually looked at a couple other things. So they did three supplemental studies. So the one they looked at more minor moral violations like stealing to see if it held up and it wasn't just for like serial killers, and it did. And then they thought that they wanted to control for, is it just people who doubt in general? So they compared not believing in gods with not believing in global warming or not believing in evolution or whatever, or not believing in horoscopes. And those did not have the same correlation that not believing in gods had. And then the other one was they tried to control for whether or not it was something specific about the specific actions themselves. And so they did a third study where they looked at, so they actually asked about a priest who molested children, and people were more likely to think the priest that molested children actually was a priest who did not believe in God than a priest who did believe in God.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I think I think addresses some of the potential confounding factors. There could obviously be others.
Absolutely.
So it's not, again, no one study is definitive. But anyway, I do think it was maybe a better study than we had given it credit for initially.
It makes me wonder why they didn't put that front and center. Because to me, that is like, wow, people.
You've got to read pretty deep into the study to get to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, even if people have an indication that this person is religious and so religious that they are, sanctioned by the church, they still think, underneath it all, they must not really believe.
Yeah.
That's the only way they could have been, a pedophile or a murderer or whatever.
Right, right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But thanks for all the feedback we got on that. I do think that that needed a second look. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney. And I challenge my fellow skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. I think I swept you guys last week.
Gosh, it was a dark moment in the history of the SGU.
It was a dark day. But you have an opportunity to make up for it this week, just like every week. There's always a new week. There's always a new science.
Redemption. Fiction.
Yes, I'm a big believer in redemption. I'm also a big believer in back-to-back sweeps, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. Ready?
Wow.
Here we go. Item number one. There's a theme here. You'll figure out the theme as we go along. Item number one. Scientists have developed a technique for imaging subjective pain intensity using electroencephalogram. Item number two. Scientists have developed a technique for imaging nerves intraoperatively using only polarized light with 100% accuracy. And item number three, researchers have developed a new MRI scan technique that allows for imaging in two colors at once. So this is anatomical imaging, different ways to image parts of the body. I'll be generous this week. I will answer all reasonable questions about this since it's very medical. Bob, go first.
Does that mean that you refuse to answer reasonable questions usually?
No.
What you just said belies that.
You might infer that from what I said. Yeah.
All right. So we've got a new technique for imaging subjective pain intensity using electroencephalogram. Damn, subjective pain using electroencephalogram. Damn, I have no idea. Let's see. The next one. So now we can look at nerves interoperatively using only polarized light. Polarized light.
So I figured this one might need some clarification.
Please.
When you open up, during surgery, open up the body, It's really hard to see stuff. I mean, you might think that, like, oh, there's an artery, and there's a nerve, and there's a muscle, but it's actually, it's all just looks like, it just looks like white, stringy stuff, yes, covered in blood. Yeah. So,
suction, please.
More suction.
Actually, it is actually really hard to see all the anatomy, and it's very easy to accidentally snip a nerve.
Oh. So we're white, Steve, we're white, stringy stuff covered in stuff like
blood.
Yeah. And our brain
pulses. Yes, it pulses. Mushes around in there, Jay.
So this way they could make the nerve stand out so that you could see it among all the other white stringy stuff. That's what they're doing here.
But I would think, all right, so I think that implies that there's some leakage from the nerves, but wouldn't the sheath on the nerve, what the hell is that, myelin?
No, the myelin and the sheath are two different things actually, but sheath around the nerve, then each axon has myelin around it.
Okay. So I would think limiting leakage like that, because we all know we hate leaks, right? That we think that would prevent that, and that would be kind of counterproductive. But then again, it might be tiny and still detectable. All right. So the third one, new MRI, which I had a few days ago, by the way. Two colors at once. Damn, I didn't look at my shoulder MRI. Maybe if it were in two colors, I'd know. But then again, this is probably far too new if it was just in the news. I can't. The only one I can have an inkling on is that stupid polarized light one, but even that might not be helpful. All right, I'm just going to go with what little I know and say that the polarized light is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, this first one that scientists developing a technique for imaging the subjective pain. Man, I really don't think that we would be able to image subjective pain intensity. I mean, so encephalogram, what does that exactly see again, Steve?
It measure the electrical activity of the brain through the scalp.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, if they're analyzing the brain and they're saying, okay, this is where the person is feeling the pain or the pain is registering in their brain here. They're feeling it in their arm, but they're registering the pain somewhere in their brain, of course. And if it's a strong signal, they can go, yeah, that's an 8 out of 10 as far as pain goes. But man, it seems also difficult to really pinpoint. That one is a big maybe, if not the fake, right out of the gate. The second one, the technique for imaging nerves. I think the only thing I don't like is the 100% accuracy part of that, but I think, you know, this one seems the most cromulent. And the last one, the new MRI scan that allows for imaging in two colors at once. Yeah, I believe that one as well. Yeah, I don't think that they can develop a technique for imaging subjective pain intensity. So I'm going to say that's the fake.
Okay, Evan.
Number one, sorry.
You don't have to say the number. The words are good.
So when it,
I said number one.
Now, when it images... when it when it images the subjective pain intensity... does it put it on that 1 to 10 scale, you know, the really frowny face and then the really happy face, and it uses that sort of emoji, you know, it just comes up on the display. You're a 6. Doctors for a very long time have been struggling with trying to quantify pain, and I have a feeling that we're still at an elusive stage here. I don't know that this one's right. The nerves, imaging nerves, using only polarized light. So therefore, if this one is true, then the nerves have a distinguishing characteristic that separates them from everything else going on in the body, in which the polarized light is able to pick up, and therefore 100% accuracy. That's tricky. The 100% accuracy is throwing me off a little bit there. And then the last one, the MRI scan that allows for imaging in two colors. That, like, remember those green screens for our computer? Everything used to be green and black. Those were your two colors back in 1988. That's kind of what I was thinking of there. Just the one that works with the dyes. You throw dyes into people and it comes out? Or is that not a necessary part of this? I don't think so.
This is with contrast, what we would call contrast.
Contrast, material. Okay.
So it could basically identify two different contrasts at the same time and give them different colors.
All right, well, I'll agree with Jay. I think they're not ready to quantify subjective pain yet. They're probably working on it, but they're not there.
Okay, and Kara.
So your clarification for Evan just made me rethink a lot of things, because off the bat, the one that stuck out to me was researchers have developed a new MRI scan technique that allows for imaging in two colors at once. Of course, MRIs don't image in color. like you add the color later, an algorithm adds the color. The scan just looks at the magnetic resonance imaging of those, what are they, the protons. So it's the excitability, and then you add the color later. And you don't even have to inject for MRI. You can do MRI that doesn't use a contrast agent. So that one stuck out to me because it seemed like weirdly simplified.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, so the colors are false colors. So what that means is that the MRI is able to image two different kinds of tissues or properties at the same time.
Gotcha. And then it would be easier to distinguish them on the MRI later when you colorize it. Okay, so that makes me rethink these. I think the one that's hopefully true and obviously true is number two, is the middle one, that scientists have developed a technique for imaging these nerves with polarized light. I think that one's science. It's freaking cool too, but it doesn't seem that far from the truth. It's like certain organs and systems have special properties, and if we can identify them accurately, you know, I don't think it's uncommon to think of a surgeon wearing special glasses or having special filters in order to more easily operate. The technique for imaging subjective pain intensity is an interesting one because it would be algorithmic, whatever it is. So you put the EEG cap on, you know, you look at these individual electrodes. Have people been able to find patterns using EEG when people experience pain? Because of course, pain, it's partially at the nerve level, but subjective pain is happening in the brain. I don't know. Now that you've clarified that, I think I'm going to go with some of the other guys and go ahead and say that the subjective pain EEG is the fiction, even though the MRI one at first, that's what I thought.
Okay. All right. Well, you all agree on the MRI one, so we'll start there. Researchers have developed a new MRI scan technique that allows for imaging in two colors at once. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay!
Yeah, yeah. So this is neat. The MRI technology just keeps improving, and it's mainly like, you know, not necessarily the machine itself, but just the software. Just finding different ways of manipulating the images or in producing the images.
That's convenient because it's a lot, you know, updating that machine would be a lot more difficult than just updating the software.
But even the machine has been updated over time to be much smaller. There are open MRIs now. Like,
yeah,
people, it's not nearly as scary.
But it's basically the same technology. It's a giant magnetic donut, you know.
And
but,
it's noisy as hell.
It's still very noisy.
Yeah, but you usually wear headphones. I don't know. It doesn't bother me. I've had so many MRIs
me at all.
Now.
What's evolving rapidly is how you use that machine and both, you know, provoking the signal and also then interpreting the data on the computer level. So we have so many more options now, so many different types of information we get from MRI scans. And when I started my career, it's really amazing. And this is potentially another advancement. So they were able to use different contrast materials that the MRI could image at the same time. So the potential advantage, this, I mean, both in research and clinically, would be when imaging organs, you could image two different aspects of the organs, either anatomy or even function, at the same time in order to correlate them. MRI scans can actually see different molecules. You know, that's kind of what they're looking for. So you could look for the distribution, you know, and concentration of different biomarkers in different tissues, and just the ability to do two at once. You know, it just opens up for other possibilities. And if history, as I said, has been any indication, I believe, you know, that the MRI scientists will find all kinds of interesting ways to exploit that. So we will see. We'll see what that turns into. Again, it's going to be, you know, don't expect to see this tomorrow, you know, when you go for an MRI scan for a routine clinical reason. There's a lot of research that has to be done, and it'll be probably used in research for a while and then trickle down to the clinical applications, you know, in years. But it's good to see that the technology is still advancing. That has been, you know, one of the most dramatic advancements in neurology during my career is how much MRI technology has taken off.
Not fMRI, or is it you're just lumping that?
Well, including fMRI, that's another one. That's just another way of doing MRI. But
yeah,
true. To look at functional activity. So absolutely, it's all part of it. All right, let's go back to number one. Scientists have developed a technique for imaging subjective pain intensity using electroencephalogram. Bob, you think this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is fiction. And this one is The Fiction.
Oh,
baby.
Wow.
Yeah, we cannot image subjective pain. Can't do it. So it's complicated. That's the problem. What we can do is use various techniques like EEG mapping or a functional MRI scan or PET scan or whatever, that things that look at brain function. We could see what parts of the brain are lighting up when people are experiencing pain. But the problem is the subjective experience of pain, how much it hurts, is modifiable by lots of different factors. And there's just no way for us to, at this point, we don't know how to take into account all of those various factors. Just your mood affects how much you experience the pain. So, mm-hmm. So we can't image that. There's no painometer, right? So that's why we still rely on patient subjective report of how much pain they're experiencing in trials. So it would be nice. It'd be awfully nice if we had a nice, accurate, non-invasive, you know, cheap, convenient way of measuring pain intensity. Even if it was reasonably accurate, that would be very useful for clinical trials.
Oh my gosh, that would be huge for palliative treatment too. Oh my gosh.
But we do not have that. Okay, which all that means that scientists have developed a technique for imaging nerves intraoperatively using only polarized light with 100% accuracy. That one is science. This is the really cool one. This was a cadaver study. So they looked at the radial nerve in a human cadaver hand and using what they call collimated polarized light imaging, CPLI, they were able to correctly identify or locate the radial nerve in, you know, basically a cadaver forearm that had been exposed. Guess how well surgeons did unaided, just surgeons just looking at the anatomy?
50%.
Hopefully better.
Yeah, well, hopefully 80%. Better.
77%. 77%.
Hey. Oh, good.
So that's, yeah, but, you know, that sounds okay, 77%, but if you're like cutting the nerve in 23% of your patients, that's not a good thing.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean that's what's happening, but I mean, yeah, so there's a big difference between 77% and 100%. So if this could, even if it's not 100%, risk management is all about getting that number as low as possible, the number of, adverse outcomes or things going bad. So if this could help surgeons identify nerves during surgery, could minimize nerve injury, accidental nerve injury, and minimize, complications of surgery. So this could be a nice little added technique to help surgeons out. So collimated polarized light. There's a video of it on the link that I'll be sharing. And it shows you, again, you'll see this massive stringy white tissue. And then when they shine the polarized light, you could see the nerve looks gray, looks a dark gray and stands out from the background of white tissue. So it's really easy to see which one of those strings is the nerve.
Mm-hmm.
This has to do with anisotropic optical reflection. So just different properties. The nerve has a different reflective property that if you're using the right, the correct polarized light, it makes it stand out. Anisotropic optical reflection. Pretty cool.
Even if there's blood over it?
Well, that the video they showed, there was no blood over it. It was. Uh-huh. But you use saline to clean away the blood. Generally, surgeons will control bleeding during the surgery and will keep blood out of their field so they can see what's going on.
I hope so. Yeah.
All right. So good job, guys. Bob, it's a challenging one this week. A little bit out of your wheelhouse, the medical one. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Science doesn't always go forwards. It's a bit like doing a Rubik's Cube. You sometimes have to make more of a mess with a Rubik's Cube before you can get it to go right. And that was said by Jocelyn Bell Burnell.
And who was she?
Northern Irish astrophysicist and the first person to discover radio pulsars while studying and advised by her thesis supervisor, Anthony Hewish, for which Hewish shared the Nobel Prize in Physics with astronomer Martin Ryle. But unfortunately, Jocelyn Bell Burnell was not recognized for her contributions.
She got asked out, yep.
Totally. And it's still a sore topic today among scientists and scholars and many people who feel that she was very deserving of being a co-award recipient because of her work. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Guys, a quick reminder, we're going to be at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia, September 1st through 4th. And we're going to be at SciCon in Las Vegas, October 26th through 29th. These are the last two conferences we have for this year. Both awesomely cool. We recommend you checking it out. We'll be doing full SGU shows at both events. And other stuff will be on a bunch of panels at DragonCon. I'm giving a solo talk also at SciCon. Lots of other great speakers. Check it out. All right, guys, and thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, brother.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Off to the eclipse.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.